Talking Bollocks, a Go Loud original podcast. Sponsored by Right Style Furniture. Right price, right style, right now. Visit rightstyle.ie.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Are you still sitting on a beanbag and you're sitting with them like you're 17?
Grow up and head to Right Style Furniture. They've got proper, comfy, stylish gear and they're Irish and family run too.
The house package is a class. For just €3,649, you get an electric sofa set, full dining setup, and beds with mattresses. That's a serious bang for your buck.
I got me corner sofa off them, and I haven't stood up since.
They've got locations in Font Hill, Belgard, and now Omni Park, open every day and late on a Thursday and Friday in Font Hill and Omni.
One-stop shop for kitting out the gaff. Don't say we never looked after you.
Exactly. Right price, right style, right now.
Visit www.rightstyle.ie. And when you shop in store, tell them Terence and Calvin sent you, and they'll throw a discount on top of that as well. So get down to Right Style Furniture today.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your weight in the ground. Till your body okay. Work it hard and long. When you finish that.
The hip knocker. Episode 276 of the Talking Bollocks podcast brought to you by Go Loud. It's me, Terry Flower.
It's me, COB.
And this week we're joined by...
Blana Drally.
Blana, first of all, how are you? How are you keeping?
Great, yeah, not a bother.
You're on your summer holidays.
On my summer holidays. I've done back-to-back holidays now. I'm just back from Dubrovnik. I was in Marbella, so I'm in full holiday mode.
I should have been a teacher.
I know, yeah.
I didn't know you were back-to-back holidays. I thought like you only finished here on Friday or something.
Well, I did, but I... scammed a couple of extra days here and there, used up days.
Do you know what I don't like about the whole thing at the end of the year with teaching? Oh, sorry, with school calendars. It's like some schools finish on like Friday and then like some schools finish on the Tuesday. I was like, well, just not just all pick a day, but like that's it.
That's it, you're done.
Like my young one school finished today. I was like, oh. It's Tuesday. What are you doing for 2 days?
Like, why wasn't it last Friday?
Yeah. Why are you going like... not just on the parents and dropping the kids to school, but the teachers still have to get up and bleed and go walk for 2 days.
And you're not doing anything at that stage.
That's what I mean.
Anyway, yeah.
I was like, what are you saying today? They're going to the park. I was like, I could have brought you to the park.
Yeah.
And that was more inconvenient for everybody.
Blotting, what we do with every guest, take us back to the start. Where are you from? What was life like growing up for you?
I'm from Mullingar, just outside the town, out in the sticks. I always say that like I'm the most basic, like... Irish girl, you know, youngest of three. I've two brothers, Austin and Dermot. And yeah, we just had the most basic like life at home, really. Have a mum and dad. And yeah, life was very normal growing up. Went to school in Mullingar, had good friends, all very steady. I'm just like never excelled really at anything, was never dreadful at anything either, just kind of a plain sailor.
Yeah.
Used to always kind of be, people would always say, if Blonard was any more laid back, she'd be horizontal. That's kind of me. But yeah, kind of enjoyed all the kind of normal things. Going out, you know, bit of sport, big into my horses always. But yeah, very kind of normal, standard life growing up, yeah.
Did you always want to be a teacher when you were growing up?
No, I wanted to be a nurse or a social worker. And everyone always said I was too soft. I'd never last. It's too sensitive.
Yeah.
But I do think, like, when I look back now, I was one of those who was like, when I was on my school holidays, I was making worksheets for my toys or, you know, that kind of thing. I was always bossy, basically. So I think the teacher is in me.
Yeah.
You know, but no, wanted to be a nurse or a social worker and then kind of fell into the teaching as a second plan.
Yeah. So you obviously then went to college.
Yeah, went to college in Limerick, down in Mary Eye.
Yeah.
Hated it. Went to like a really small secondary school, Wilson's, in, you know, the Enoch Burke school. That's where I went.
I love the way it's known as the Enoch Burke school.
Enoch Burke. It's a good icebreaker though, isn't it?
Yeah, isn't it? Yeah. Went there and so it was really small and kind of like... in a way hillbilly-ish, but lovely. Like it's away up in the hills. It's not near anything. And we'd always like, people would be like, oh, that's a private school. But like, it was only like, we got the kickouts from every other school, all the Dublin private schools, anyone who'd been expelled, we'd take them. So it was just the biggest group of misfits. And then I went down to Mary Eye, which was kind of very like GA focused. You weren't in the crew if you didn't play hurling your whole life or you weren't from Clare or Kerry. And I just kind of, it was a totally different vibe. All my friends went to like Galway or Dublin, so I was a bit of a fish out of water down there. And just always wanted to kind of get back up home. I hated it. I used to go down on a Tuesday. I'd say, oh, I've no lectures on a Monday or something. I always had. And I'd be back up on a Thursday. I absolutely hated it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was my college life.
Blan, and you're here to discuss a very kind of serious subject matter. And yeah. I don't really know how to initiate this conversation because we're having a good laugh there off here.
Yeah.
But as you said before we got recording that, it is a very serious topic. And do you want to kind of lead the way?
I can lead the way, yeah.
But only go into as much detail or whatever as you feel.
Yeah, and I suppose I'm probably so used to talking about it, I forget that it's kind of quite like jarring for other people or people feel kind of uncomfortable about it. So as I'm so kind of used to it now that I kind of just say it and then I see the like horror in people's face. I'm like, oh God. But I was raped when I was 21, quite violently, by a guy that I met on a night out from Mullingar. I was on a night out in Galway with some friends and I went back to a house party. And I knew of this guy through my brothers, through the local rugby club. And we kind of went back and I had lost my friends and didn't really know how to get home where we were staying. And he said, oh, you can come back with us. We're having a party. The usual, you know, when you're having great crack and you think, oh, I don't want this night to end. And went back to this house party and all was grand. He was really normal. And the house party kind of died off and he just switched from this really normal guy, I suppose, to give a bit of backstory. I was 21. I was on my summer holidays from college. It was like July 2018 or 2019. I can't remember now. And I was, like I said, so basic. You know, I drove a little Fiat 500 and I loved going out and makeup. And it was, you know, and he was this really basic guy. He was doing an apprenticeship. He had a great group of friends. He was a rugby player, had a job, the whole lot. And our groups kind of just mixed. We all knew similar people from Mullingar. Our groups mixed in the pub on the night out, went back to this house party. And he went from being this really, really normal person to he went to turn the lights off to go upstairs to bed himself. And he turned, switched off the light and he just changed. Like he went from being chatty and normal to just extremely hostile, instantly like angry, aggressive. The assault happened, started in the house, in the living room, in the house. You know, he like pulled the clothes off me, kind of was quite rough inside. And then he suggested going out for a cigarette outside. And I thought, okay, this might calm the whole situation down. Because I kind of, at the time, didn't think that it was, even though like a sexual assault had happened in the house, I didn't think what would happen was, that wasn't my fear. My fear was actually that he was going to hit me or, you know, beat me up because he just seemed so angry and he was like, you know, for fuck's sake. And it's just, this was completely out of nowhere. So we got outside, ended up, he locked me into a garden shed in the back of this Airbnb and he raped me. And when he couldn't do what he wanted to do himself, he used plastic bottles as well. And I got out, was some other people at the party that came down for a cigarette, and I was able to, when they came down, I was able to knock on the door and they let me out, and I was able to get out of the house then that night. And I just left the house straight away. I had some quite significant injuries and stuff like that, but I just needed to get out. So I walked down the street in Galway and met some strangers coming out of a casino at 6 o'clock in the morning who were probably coked off their head and, you know, they were having a great time. And they met me and they looked after me. And one guy kind of was talking to me and there was a girl talking to me more, but I just kept saying, I can't find my friends and I want to go home. And all I could think of was, I just want to go home and get into the shower. Like, I need to get this feeling off me. And I just kept saying, I can't find my friends. And this guy, he just picked up on the whole situation and he just kept saying, I think you need to go to the guards. I think something has happened to you and I really want you to go to the guards. And they walked me down to the Garda station in Galway that night, and I arrived in at 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning, and I reported it straight away, and then was brought to the sexual assault treatment unit, and the guards went, we drove around Galway until we kind of managed to find the house I had come from, because I didn't know where I had really come from, and they were able to secure the house and all of that. So yeah, that was kind of what started all of this, I suppose.
Sorry, because it's a bit heavy. Yeah. Look,
it is heavy, you know. Yeah. And it's, I suppose, like I said, I talk very openly about it now, and I kind of, for other people, I don't maybe realise the weight of it, or sometimes it's like I'm not talking about myself. Mm. You know, it's like a different person. Yeah. But yeah, it is. It's quite gruesome and kind of mad, yeah.
That's kind of what I wanted to ask you there. Like, when you went down and you met them strangers, did you know the weight of it at that time there and then? Did you know, like, I need to get to the police now, that, or?
No. First of all, I wanted to just get home. And I didn't tell the people I had met what had happened at all. And even when I went into the guards, I just went up to the desk at the front. This girl walked me up and I said that there had been an assault. I had been assaulted, and he was kind of looking at me. And I was like, I thought in my head that I was very calm. But after the trial and after those guards had talked, like, they had notes and everything, and they described this girl coming in with her clothes on, her inside out, disheveled. I had splinters down my face where I had been pushed into the door. I, you know, obviously looked a mess, and I was shivering and shaking. But I told him, because it took me so long to be able to say what had happened. And I felt like straight away I couldn't say I had been sexually assaulted or I had been raped, because they'd be like, no, that's not what that is. Or, do you know, like, I was like, I can't accuse somebody of that. That's massive. So I didn't really realise the gravity of it straight away. And it wasn't until I was like, the poor guard at the front desk, then when I said, like, oh, it's a sexual assault, I could just see the panic in his face, like, oh shit. And he's like, oh, you'll have to go into the back for that. So I was brought into the back room and I was interviewed then, and then I kind of realized there was more and more kind of people coming into me and explaining stuff. And I'd say I didn't really realise for a long time the gravity of it. It wasn't until the detective dealing with the case said to me after, like, he had been charged at this stage, so maybe a year or so after it. And she said, like, there's rape, which is bad, like, awful. And she's like, and there's this, like, she was like, there's a different severity or badness to this. And I suppose I didn't really see that, you know, see that violence in it, or I didn't allow kind of that, because I think in a way your brain kind of doesn't allow you accept how bad things can be. It's nearly like a protection thing. Yeah. If you allowed yourself to sit with it is like a coping mechanism. I think if you allowed yourself to kind of think of that, you'd never do anything.
You said, she said it's rape and then a different severity. Did they give, like, a name, or, like, did they categorise it, like?
He was charged with rape and then aggravated sexual assault, which is, it's, they give the title of, so it was a section 3, so the most severe section, but it's aggravated because of the violence in it. That was for the bottles and that kind of thing. But, you know, like, people often said to me afterwards, like, you know, when you hear the fact that he used plastic bottles, you think, oh my God, that is sick. Like, what sort of a freak is into something like that? And I thought that at the start, and wasn't until I kind of learned more about these kind of crimes that it's not like a fantasy. It's not a sexual thing for somebody like that. It's a power and a control and, like, a way to hurt you. It's not for a pleasure or, you know, a kink, I suppose. It's to degrade and to hurt. So it's a, you know, it's a different kind of a thing. But yeah, so aggravated sexual assault is the violent kind of part.
Did the police then go up and check the property and arrest him initially, or?
Yeah. So the guards got into the house, I think, at about 9:30 or 10 o'clock that morning. and all the other people were still in the house. Everything was untouched. So, like the shed, everything. So they were able to clear the crime scene, and they just kept Johnny Moran was the guy's name, and his brother, they just kept them there, and he was then brought in straight away for interview. And like instantly, you know, he said he didn't know who I was, he didn't know my name, then he'd use my name and, you know, things like that. And like even the way he spoke in interview, like he said that I had been there till 8 o'clock cuddling him on the couch, even though there was CCTV of me leaving at like five, you know, things like that. But yeah, they got in straight away, thankfully, and were able to get everything and photograph the place. And, you know, it hadn't been touched. Nobody had really moved since I had left.
Yeah. But that was like nowhere near. That was just the start of this journey then that you would have to go on, a traumatic journey, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
For them couple of years then in the aftermath. But yeah. Did you have an idea of what was going on when he was arrested and questioned straight away, or are you just sitting in the dark?
You're totally in the dark. So, like, I was so naive. I thought, like, when I reported it first and then, you know, the detectives came down to talk to me as well, and I had to make a statement and I had to give my phone over and all this kind of stuff. And I thought, like, this will be done and dusted in a year. Do you know, like, I was so naive to even how these things worked. But I was more or less completely in the dark. Like, I think when my phone was taken, it could have been gone for nearly a year. I think it took 2.5 years to get charges to come back from the DPP. The trial took us 5 years to get to trial. And, like, in that time, we're both in Mullingar. His life is completely normal. And mine couldn't be further from what it had been, do you know, like in those 5 years, I just completely changed as a person. I was a totally different person. But yeah, you're completely in the dark, and you think sometimes you're like, this is so unfair. Why am I being treated like the one that's done something wrong here? Like, I know nothing. I don't know what's going on. I don't know. Like, I didn't know up until we went to trial if they had gotten the bottles from the house. I didn't know what evidence they had. So you're going in blind, and it's really hard. You feel so out of control or something. And that's a massive thing with, like, sexual violence. Control is massive, because control has been taken away from you, and power. And then you feel like you're in this situation again where everybody else is in control of a situation. Everybody else knows what's going on apart from you. And it's really, yeah, it's horrible.
Do you want to ask, if you can, tell us what the aftermath was actually like for you? Because obviously you've gone through this traumatic event, and then it's 5 years before you even get the trial. And I know you said there that you were a different person.
Yeah.
What kind of headspace were you in for, obviously, the few months after, but then all that time, when you're probably looking, and it probably looks like he's living a normal life.
Yeah.
Up until then.
So, like, at the start, I suppose, probably adrenaline is really high at the start. So for the first few weeks, I was like, I'm going to be fine. This is fine. And like a bit like, you know, those cringy, like sayings, like, this doesn't define you. And like, he's taken enough. Don't let him take your, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I was like, yeah, that's going to be me. And I was like, I'm going to be fine. Like, I'm so lucky. Like, you know, I got to report it. There's plenty of people who don't know who attacked them, or all these things. But then it was like, slowly but surely, I just noticed things changing. So like, one of the first things was, my mum brought me to Liffey Valley one day to go shopping. And I was walking around, fella walked by me, and he obviously had the same aftershave that he had worn that night. And I just started to, I was like, I have to go, I'm going to get sick. And then it'd be things like, you know, so it was all really small things. Then I noticed that if I went out anywhere, because I was like, I can still go out, you know, this was kind of in the first few months. And I found I'd go into a pub and I'd be fine, but I'd have to sit with my back to a wall. I'd have to be able to see everybody coming in and out. I'd watch every guy that a girl was talking to in case I needed to identify him because she had been raped. I'd look, if there was a girl drunk or something, I'd be like, where are her friends? She's going to be raped, you know. And I took all of this on, and then I stopped going out and stopped kind of socialising with my friends. And I hate, like, I hated myself. I felt that, like, I had let this happen to me. I didn't fight him. Like, I should have fought him. I didn't fight him. And it'd be like, I couldn't let myself get my hair done. I couldn't let myself buy myself new clothes because I didn't deserve it. I was, you know, I felt dirty. I felt used. I wasn't worth anything. He didn't see me being anything. You know, I must have been an easy target. And it's all of this. And I totally withdrew from everything. I'd go through phases of not being able to sleep, like horrific nightmares, just playing the whole thing over and over again. Or being like, I need to remember every detail of what happened. So I'd like lie in bed and like go through the night. Like, and then at 10 o'clock, I had such a thing to drink. And then so that I wouldn't forget anything. I'd say my motivation for life just went. I never was suicidal, but I was dull. I had no joy in my life. I was so numb. I withdrew from everything. I didn't go on holidays. I didn't do anything nice. I was horrible to myself, you know, after it. And I lived in fear. Like, I hadn't had that fear since I was a child. I've been you know, when you're a child and you watch a scary movie or something, you're really afraid of the big bad man or someone coming to take you. I was convinced that he was going to kill me. He was going to find me and kill me, because I was like, there's no way he's going to do this, like what he's done, and let me live and let this happen. Like, there's no way. And I then COVID hit and everybody was kind of at home anyway. So in a way, that kind of suited me. And it wasn't really until, I'd say maybe 8 months before the trial was due to start, that I was like, right, you need to get yourself in a place where you can face this, because you're going to have to face them. So you need to pick yourself up. I gained a huge amount of weight. I was just miserable. I was just like a hermit, really.
Were you going to counselling?
Went to counselling. It started counselling more or less straight away. I went to the Rape Crisis Centre in Tullamore, and they were excellent. Like, and it was weekly at the start and then fortnightly. But like, I was really good at, like, I'd go to the counsellor and I wouldn't want her to feel bad about herself, like think she wasn't doing a good job. So I'd tell her I was doing great, and I could be brutal. Like, I mightn't have slept, and I'd be like, I'm doing really well this week, you know, or she'd be like suggesting something, and I'd be like, I tried that journaling. It worked wonders for me. And I'd be in an awful state. I spent so much time sitting, staring into space. I think I was so exhausted. Then my doctor gave me Xanax for a while, so I was like out of it. It was just, yeah, it was bleak. I was robbed of those years and that part. Like, I look back now and I think, what did I do for those years? You know what I mean? Like, it was a very, it robbed everything. I often say it was like a bomb went off in my personality, and I had to build a personality all over again, you know, try and put the pieces back together. And like, some of them are the same, but there's a lot of things that are very different now than, you know, the old person. But yeah, it was paralyzing. I was just stuck. I always felt like I was stuck, and I felt so lonely. Like, no matter what I did, whether I went to counseling, whether I talked to people, I thought nobody gets this. Or, you know, I talked to somebody and they'd suggest something and I'd just agree with them to make them feel better about it. But yeah, it was very, very bleak.
Mm. Did people in your circle know what happened, or were you not allowed to discuss it with them because there's a case going on? Like,
my very close circle knew. So like, my family, my immediate family, and some of my really close friends knew what had happened. And it took a while. Like, when it happened, I rang my mom and I told her, like, you can't tell dad. Like, again, I was so naive to think that this was just going to go away. But obviously we did tell my dad. And then it took a few weeks before, or a few days maybe, before he could tell my brothers. And then it took a while. It actually wasn't until right before the trial that one of my brothers said to my mom, will you actually tell me what happened? Because I don't actually know fully what happened. And he was like, I feel like I need to know. My friends knew, like my very close friends. But other than that, people didn't really know. And like that again, I had to watch him go about his normal life and, you know, all those sorts of things. And it was, I suppose people were probably looking at me thinking, what happened to her? Like, where, you know, where did it all go wrong for her? But yeah, it was mad.
That's what I wanted to ask you, Blotna. Did you know about his life during them 5 years? Was he just living a normal life? Was he working a job? Was everything just normal?
Yeah. So he just stayed like completely normal. So he didn't tell anyone. He had a girlfriend. He stayed in his relationship. He didn't tell her. I think he stayed in his job. He stayed playing rugby. And like that had been, the rugby club was the club that I had grown up in and the boys had grown up playing in. So it was very central to our lives. And then that was gone. And, you know, like naturally we like on Instagram or whatever, and you'd see, you know, like man of the match, or there was a big post about him one day that he had played 100, he had 100 caps for the club, and what a great club man he was and what a great, you know, person he was. And I was like, oh my God, how is this happening? And I always thought, like, because he was on bail at the time, so obviously he was checking into the Garda station. I always thought, like, for such a small town, how do people not know this? Yeah. Like, how has this not gotten out? Because you know the way you hear things, like whispers of things. And I was like, how? And it really didn't seem to get out. But he was living a totally normal life. But even to a kind of worrying extent, like even when he was found guilty, so with the charges he had, he was always getting a custodial sentence. Like there was no kind of option for a suspended sentence or anything like that. But he went back to his job in between being found guilty and sentenced, and like applied for holidays and interviewed for a new job, and like told them he couldn't take it because there was weekend work and he plays rugby at the weekends. Like he was like full sure that his, like, nothing was going to catch up with them.
I was going to say, do you think he was just completely in denial?
Denial. I think he hid it for so long from everybody that he nearly convinced himself that it wasn't. Like, the jury gave the verdict. He didn't accept the verdict. That didn't happen. And you're just like, well, everybody is telling you now it has. And I think he nearly convinced himself that it wasn't going to catch up with him.
How long after the incident, did he get charged? How long did it take for them to actually press charges?
I think 2 years, 2 to 2.5 years. Yeah, it took so, so long. It was, and like, you don't know what charges they're going to bring, if they are going to bring charges. So you're really on a, and then they bring the charges and you're like, oh, great. But then you don't
really.
Then he's out on bail. Yeah, yeah.
Do you think that kind of played into his psyche then? Because it took so long for it to come back up.
I'd say he thought nothing's going to happen with this. Like if it's taken them this long, nothing's going to, you know, they mustn't have case or nothing's going to happen out of this. I reckon he just had himself convinced that he was in the clear.
And then for you, so he didn't get charged for 2 years, 2.5 years. Did you, like, were you in the loop that he's going to get charged at some stage? Or were you sitting there going, is he ever going to get charged?
Yeah, so I didn't know. So we were just waiting for the DPP to come back with the file. Like, so you're waiting to hear. And I think it wasn't until, so he was arrested and charged. And it wasn't until after all of that was done that the guards then came to me and told me what he had been charged with. But then once he was charged, he was out on bail again. So, like, he was out the whole time for the 5 years. Just a little more.
I just can't believe that you're the victim of this, and then you're left for 2 or 2.5 years, not even knowing when he's getting charged or what he's getting charged with. Or
yeah, and you genuinely have no idea. There's no inclination. You don't know, like, how long do you think that'll take? Don't know. Takes out. It depends whose desk it lands on. And you think, like, who is reading it? Like, how can nobody see that there's somebody else's life on the other side 100%. Of this? Do you know, like, you are never, ever seen in any of it. Like, as a victim of it, you are never seen. Like, even when you get to court, you're not a victim, you're a witness. So it's not about you. Like, you are never, you're a witness for the state. So it's not you against him, it's the state against him, and you're just the witness. So, like, he gets to see, like, your statement, he gets to see the book of evidence, all of that before the trial. You don't see anything. You know, you're cross-examined on the stand. So, like, I had to go, my barrister had to, well, not my barrister, but the state's barrister goes through the whole thing and goes through all the evidence and all of that. And then his barrister gets up and basically tries to discredit you and questions you. But he has right, he doesn't have to speak. So he never spoke the whole time of the 2 week trial. He never said a word. He never had to defend a thing. Because I used to think, how's he going to, like, there was DNA evidence and there was, you know, like the doctor's reports, and I'd be like, how's he going to
get out of
this? Yeah, what's he going to say? And I didn't know until like 2 weeks before the trial that he actually doesn't say anything. He doesn't have to defend himself at all. He doesn't have to say anything.
Yeah, so they're proving you're in the right more than they're proving he's in the wrong.
Yeah, so you basically have to prove his guilt rather than him prove his innocence.
Yeah.
And that's really hard. Because you're going through all this, but you think, well, if I have to do it, at least he has to do it too. And then he doesn't. And you're like, oh, for fuck's sake.
Did they use your counselling notes?
They didn't use mine. They looked for them. They didn't use them. I don't think there was anything in them. But, like, again, the first day you go for counselling, you're told his team will come and look for these. So, you know, be mindful for what you say in here, because we legally have to take notes and they can be used.
That's horrific.
It's so contradictory,
isn't it?
Well,
like, it's
tell us how you really feel, but be careful of what you say.
Yeah, and they're caught it. Like, I really feel for the counsellors. They're in a position where they don't want to do it. They think it's horrific. Yeah. And, like, you have the Department of Justice, you know, telling people to use these services and stuff like that. And then you're told, well, these actually can be used. And they are used, you know, in trials against people. And also, it's like, for a lot of people, they don't have another support circle outside. Maybe their counsellor is the only person outside of reporting this that knows. They mightn't have family and friends. And, like, that's such a breach of trust. It's a horrible, horrible thing. It's the only crime that's done in. It just makes no sense, you know. Like, why you think it's okay to, you know, use somebody's counselling notes, the most private place, the only support that's there for somebody after this, you know, like, okay, you have to wait 5 years. Okay, he mightn't actually be prosecuted. Okay, even then, on top of that, the one support that's there for you isn't really fully yours either. Mm. Again, it's a breach of your privacy. It's a breach of your, like, that power and control again is stripped from you. Mm. And it's like, they use this term like re-traumatization, like it's
living it again.
Again. It's bizarre.
Did you said that you got the trial date a few months before and you kind of, that gave you kind of a jolt.
Yeah.
What was that like for you?
It was like getting ready for battle. I think I was like, I need to, like, be strong for this. And I worked really, really hard. I got like my weight under control. I got exercise and I got my head in a good space. I really worked, really picked myself up. And then my trial was supposed to be in October and it was supposed to start on the Monday. And they rang me then to say there wasn't enough judges and it was going to be pushed to the next day. And then I got a call to say, not enough judges today. Again, the next day, on the third day, they rang and said, and I said, it's going to be Monday. And she said, it's going to be next year. So I had, and I had been given my statement, which was like the report I had given the morning it had happened. And there was huge detail because obviously it was so fresh at that stage. And I had been given the statement and I couldn't sleep for weeks. I was studying it like I was, you know, ready. And then it was just pulled from me. And I remember it was the only time I lost it. on the phone to the detective, and she was like, I know you're disappointed. And I was like, you don't fucking get this. This is my life. Like, you know, I had taken time off work, even down to really simple things that, yeah, I was very fortunate that it was grand for me. But there's a lot of other people who that wouldn't be okay for. Or, you know, again, people might know they might have kids at home, you know, all that. And it was just ripped from me. I wasn't even given another date. It was just, you'll get it when you get it. You'll hear when you hear, you know. And it was, yeah, I was like, and at that stage, I thought, I'm not doing this. I'm done. This is a sign. Nothing good is going to come of this. Nothing good has come of it. I'm not like, I'm done with this. I need my life back, because I had put my life on hold. I wanted to go back and do a master's, and I kept saying, I'm not doing it yet because I don't want to do it when the trial is on, because I'm not giving them this as well. I'm not giving them, you know. And I had waited like all these years, and I just kept snowballing. And then, yeah, you're not even given a date. But then we did get going. So that was the October. And then my trial started in April. So I had about maybe 6-7 months further on from the original date I was given. But it was cruel. Like, it was a cruel thing. You feel like a puppet and everybody else is just controlling your life.
It's absolutely cruel, Blanton. It's like, it's the most serious a crime, and it's almost like they treat it like it's the most...
Yeah.
Leanest.
Yeah, like, that I was pickpocketed or something, you know.
100%,
like,
100%. And it's not saying that other crimes aren't, but it's like, they're treating it like it's minimal. Like, this is like, at the taking over someone's whole life.
Yeah, and you know what I mean? Like I said, like, I felt like I had done the crime. Do you know that, like, well, deal with it.
But like you said as well, though, like, he gets 5 years before the trial and just gets to go about his life. And then even, I know there's a sentence after the trial, but even during the trial, he doesn't have to open his mouth. And you have to go up and, you know what I mean? You're getting cross-examined, and it's just like, no wonder women don't go forward.
Go forward, yeah. And you say, like, okay, he gets a sentence, and that's brilliant. And, like, he got a very strong sentence. He got 9 years with one suspended for entering a bond or something, so 8 years, which was extremely strong for a first time conviction and an incident in isolation. They wouldn't normally get, normally they get maybe 4 years for something like that. But like, it comes with a life sentence for me. Like, I did the 5 years before it, I'll do the years after it. Like, you know, there's no real validation in that. But yeah, I look sometimes and I think, why would you come forward? And like, there's only 5% of sexual assaults and rapes reported in the country. And you think, that's why. 5% is tiny, you know. Why would you?
I think there's a small percentage that actually got over the line
as
well.
That's only,
isn't it?
Like, so that's 5% that report. So what's the conviction rate then is going to be tiny.
Yeah, it's so small.
Yeah.
So I remember reading about that before and just thinking, like, it's the worst possible crime you can think. And then it's like, why would you go forward? Doesn't seem to be anything at the end that justifies the trauma you're going through.
Yeah. Like, when I look back, I think, like, oh, if I was to do it again, would I not report? I definitely would. But that's probably because I'm thick. Like, I'd be bitter. I'd be like, no, fuck you, I'm going to get you. But I can see, like, why for some people it's just not, one, it's just not an option. And two, like, they just think, I can't put myself through this. Like, and I totally can understand that. And I also had the comfort of, like, I knew I had been to SATU. So I knew there would be medical evidence. I knew the guards had gotten to the house. So I was, like, lucky. Do you know, they were the things I had to comfort myself, that I have some concrete evidence. Like, there's so many people going into cases where it's like, he says, she says, and you think, how
are you
going
to prove that?
Yeah, and how could you face that? Like, that is soul destroying.
I know you're saying, like as a woman, you can see why they don't kind of go forward, but that's why I think as well we need powerful women like you. And we had a previous guest on, Sarah
Grace.
You're
not the first person to say and tell the story.
But it's powerful for you to go public and optionally go on radio shows and podcasts and speak about the event in detail and show people how traumatising it is for you. And I'm sure it's not easy telling the story over and over again for yourself, but for any woman out there that's kind of been through a case like that, at least you was out here saying, look, you can't, there's...
There is success in this.
Yeah, that can be success.
Yeah, you can actually get to a finish point with this. Yeah, oh, 100%. And like that was like the main reason for me waiving my anonymity at the end of the trial was because I had spent so long, like I could nearly tell you every sentence of every rape case in the country because I used to study them. Like at night when I was waiting for my trial, I used to read like the court reports. I'd look up the court dates. I was such a freak, like, and read all the reports. And I knew the like everything about them because I just needed to feel in control or be able to kind of guess what was going to happen. Like I had never been to a Garda station. I had never been in court. I didn't know how any of that worked and it was so overwhelming. I felt like the biggest idiot in the room. Like I was the only person who didn't know what was going on, how these things worked, and you're always the last one to find out. Do you know that sort of a way? But like with those cases, it was never somebody that you could be like, oh, she got there or she was my age or, you know, and it happened for her and that's the fellow who did it to her or, you know, and I just thought, that's what, like, I would have taken great comfort in that and seeing somebody like, okay, there is actually people who do get there with this.
Yeah. And just on that topic there, when you were reading about, like, the other cases that were happening and stuff, was there a sense of, like, why am I even at the doing this? Were you looking at cases being like, they're not even getting over the line there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you'd look at, like, what evidence did they have? What swayed it? You know, all those sort of things. And you think, oh, God. And like every day you'd go into the trial and it'd be like, we'd sit there and my family would come with me. And my brother said to me one day, we were coming out and like, he's 4 years older than me. So he's, you know, in his late 20s at the time. And he was like, Blanet, I love you. But if I ever hear about your vagina ever again, I swear to God, you know. So they were having to sit there and like, see all of this and hear all of this, and it was so heavy for them. It was the first time they were ever confronted with it because obviously I knew what the house looked like, I knew what he looked like, I knew all those things. They didn't, so they were confronted then, like all those missing gaps. They now had the imagery of all of that, and it really took them a long, long time. I think the court, the trial process really hit them harder than it did when it happened to me. You know, I suppose probably was very traumatizing for me at the time. It was more for them after all of that kind of thing. But yeah, it's just, you just think, I would like be like, okay, well, like nearly, yeah, every day, like that's a good day. Like, okay, we have this point, that point. Like, how's he going to argue that? How's, and then the next day you'd come out and you'd think, there's not a hope. There's not a hope. And you're sitting there and the judge charges the jury with their like role and responsibility. And you're sitting there thinking, how is anybody ever found guilty of a crime? Because it's such a big thing. And, you know, there's like, if you have any doubt and, you know, reasonable doubt and all this kind of stuff. And you're sitting there and you think, this is a waste of time. Why are we putting ourselves through this? But I think that kind of side of it is just part of the process. And I do think once you get it to trial, I always try and say to people, if they charge them and if you're getting a trial, it's, yeah, you're in a good place.
Well, I want to go back a bit because you said it was 5 years between it happening and the trial and he was living a normal life. But you both still lived in Mullingar. He's kind of moving in the same circle. Did you ever cross paths with him?
Twice. Once going into Dunn's and he was with his girlfriend and I remember seeing him and he looked straight through me like I wasn't there. And then another night in a pub and he did the same thing. He never acknowledged me. He didn't feel uncomfortable. He didn't, you know, like, oh shit, is she going to say something now to somebody or nothing. He just like had no fear. I was nothing, do you know? That used to make me even more angry because I'd be like, you don't even care. Like, you don't think I'm going to do anything about this. You think you've won this.
Yeah, like it didn't have to hold over him that I had over you.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And I'd get so angry. And well, I'm not an angry kind of a person, but that used to drive me insane. See, arrogance, and that's a trait that a lot of sexual offenders have is this arrogance, you know, of like, they can step back out in public and in their normal lives and stuff. They don't have that shame or that embarrassment or that worry, which it used to drive me mad.
And he played for the same team as your brother?
Yeah. So he played rugby with Dermot for years, and then Dermot ended up leaving Mullingar Rugby Club after it happened, because obviously he was like, he couldn't say anything. We couldn't be like, oh, well.
Is that a legal thing?
Yeah.
He's not allowed to can't yeah.
say somebody has done that, you know. So he went and played with Tullamore, who'd be our next town over. So the two clubs would be rivals. And every year they had a match, a Towns Cup match. And Dermot didn't play it for the first couple of years. And he played it the last year, which would have been like maybe the February, March before the trial, which was in April. So a couple of weeks before the trial. And Johnny Moran played the match against him and had no problem playing, and actually stood in the line at the end to shake hands. And like, I don't know how he kept his calm. I don't know how he played the match, but yeah, he didn't care.
Presumably they obviously didn't shake hands.
No. No.
But like, is no one else looking at this being like,
this is weird.
Something's off here.
Yeah, and like some of the other lads were like to him, like, oh, come on in for a drink. Like, why did you leave? Oh, you think you're better than the rest of us, you know, because Tullamore would have been a higher division or whatever. Like, oh, you think you're a great lad, don't you? And then like, don't be like that. Come in for a drink. Why won't you come in for a drink? And, you know, all this kind of stuff. And he never, to be fair to him, he never said a word. He bit his tongue and waited. He feels a huge amount of responsibility, I think, for the fact that Johnny Moran came and spoke to me and my friends because they knew Dermot, and he used that as an in. And he has a massive amount of guilt that he feels like, well, if I didn't know him, he might not come over, or, you know. And he often says, I find it very hard to trust people after that, which is understandable. But yeah, that's kind of one of the bits that I hold a bit of anger towards, you know. I'm kind of like, ugh.
Do you feel vindication?
Yeah, I do. I feel like I got my vindication when 11 strangers heard the evidence in a courtroom and unanimously decided that he had done that. And for me, that was huge, because before the verdict, I never felt I had a right to say that I had been raped. I never felt I could say that, because it wasn't, I didn't get a conviction, or, you know, he wasn't in prison or whatever. I didn't feel like I had the right to say that. And I think that's a cultural thing. Hmm. You know, I think a lot of people think that, like, if you say, you know, I was assaulted or something, they'll say, oh, well, is he in jail? Or, you know, and it's almost like, well, if he's not, it didn't happen, or, you know. But no, I do feel like I got vindication from that process, yeah.
What's your opinion on the sentence?
I think it's a strong sentence. Like, in my head, is any sentence ever going to be strong enough? No, but he's going to get out, and I'm going to have to navigate a life where he's out and, you know, whatever. And I know there's so many people who don't get their attackers are never in prison, and they never get that. Like, I have a great sense of freedom now that I get to go and live my life, and I'm not looking around every corner, you know, thinking, oh, he could be here. Whereas there's a lot of people who don't get that, who'll never have a day in their lives where they don't have that. I get that for 8 years or six or seven, whatever he'll do. But I'd obviously love to see him locked up for a lot longer, but that's not going to happen. But I think the sentences are strong enough for the crimes that are committed against people? No, I don't. I think when you look at the cases and stuff that are coming out, they're extremely violent. Like, gone is the day of, again, I like say, like, your conventional rape. Like, every case is so violent. It's women being beaten, tortured, all these things. Like, I think, like, anal rape and stuff like that is huge. It's actually nearly more common now than again, your conventional rape. But, like, those sentences are 5 or 6 years. Does that equate to the cost on your life? No, I don't think it does.
No.
But
that's why when you started telling your story here today, you said you were raped violently, and some man who did this is going to do probably 6 or 7 years in prison. Like, and
yeah.
You think, what?
Yeah.
Like, how do we not look at people like that found guilty unanimously by 11 people in a jury, as you said, and we think it's okay to just go 9 years, one to spend, you'll do 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
How is that not 20 years in prison?
Yeah, and people say like, yeah, but he'll never live a normal life. And you think, okay, I know what you mean. But in a lot of senses, when he comes out, he will live a normal life. Like, he'll get some form of a job doing something. He'll have his family, you know, like, he will live a normal enough life. He could go to the UK or something, or, you know, somewhere and pick up a normal enough life. Okay, it mightn't be like, yeah, to an extent, it's always going to catch up with him, but it's not going to be life ending for him. You know, he will live a somewhat normal life, I think.
Yeah, well, to the point where you would nearly hope that when someone is walking down the street like that, everybody in the whole world...
Yeah, you should nearly have to wear a T-shirt.
Yeah, honestly, yeah. Like, but... I don't know what you're saying. Like, you could literally move to another country and...
But, yeah. But do you feel empowerment now, knowing that he's known as Johnny Moran, the rapist?
Yeah, I do. I get a little bit of joy from that because I think you were so arrogant and you thought I would do nothing. Like, you thought you could do that and you did it so openly, and you didn't, like, in ways I think you didn't even try and hide it. You didn't even try to clean up after yourself or, you know, anything. You thought you could do that and I would do nothing, and I was worth nothing, that it was okay to do that to somebody. That I think, well, I don't think he ever thought I would get him to prison, or I don't think he ever thought he had anything to be afraid of. And I often just hope that those first few days when he was in Mountjoy, I really hope he felt the fear, that being afraid that I felt of him for all those years. Even if he only had a couple of days of it, I hope he felt like, oh my God, I can't sleep, I can't, you know, of anything else, just for him to feel that.
This is very personal, and feel free to not answer, yeah. But what is, since that, what's your relationship like with men?
It's quite good, in the sense of, like, I never had that fear of it happening again. But it does, it definitely leaves a lasting, like, impact, like, even on relationships and stuff. Like, I see now I'm in a relationship, a really healthy relationship with somebody really lovely. And it does have a huge weight on it. Like, one, it's like another element of your relationship. And then two, it's like, I am a very, because of it, I'm a very insecure person. You know, I do sometimes that thought process of, I'm not worth anything, or I'm disgusting, or I'm dirty, or I'm, you know, I don't feel clean because of it. That comes into your relationship. And that's a hard thing to battle with, and it's hard for somebody else to understand. And it's a huge thing for somebody to try and undertake and understand. And, like, people will often say, like, yeah, but if they're the right one, it won't matter. And it doesn't matter. Like, it's not that someone's like, oh, but it's a huge undertaking, and it's a delicate thing, and it's hard for somebody else to understand and navigate as well. Like, it's hard for somebody else to know to say the right thing to comfort you, or, you know, how to navigate different things. It's hard because they don't understand maybe the reason why you don't like somebody walking up behind you that closely on the stairs, or why you don't want to watch that new series on Netflix because it's really violent and you actually don't have any tolerance for violence anymore. Like, even down to, we're watching this thing on Netflix at the moment, and I got 2 episodes in and it's quite, like, intense, and I actually had to look up spoilers for it because I needed to know what happened before I watched the rest of it. You know, things like that, like, it leaves a huge trace on your life. Like, I have quite strong PTSD, and, like, there's days where I could be walking around and I will see Johnny Moran. It could be in a shop or something like that. And it takes me a second to talk myself that, like, that's not him. It can't be him. It's not him. Do you know? So it has a huge lasting impact, and that brings it into your relationship. So I have a very trusting nature towards men. I don't think, like, I don't have that, like, I hate men thing. But I do see the impact it has on my, like, romantic relationships, I suppose, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, and I appreciate you answering that, because I was wondering, because it'd be very understanding for you not to trust men.
Yeah.
And I get that.
Yeah, but, and people have different, like, a lot of people who have been victims of sexual violence will have different experiences. Some girls or guys can't go near men. Some girls and guys get really, like, promiscuous and go with loads of men. Like, it, people react very, very differently. But I'm glad I didn't have that, like, I'm glad I don't have that where I feel like every man is capable of doing that to me, because I think that would be very hard
to navigate,
get over. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It'll be very limiting in your life, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially when you're so young.
You wrote a book.
I did, yeah.
What was that like for you, the process of doing that?
Sorry, you seem so shocked about that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, shocked it did.
Yeah.
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 I forgot about that. Yeah, I did. I wrote a book with Niall Kelly. He's a sports writer. So I decided to go with a male writer because I wanted sort of a male influence on the book. And I liked the fact that Niall was into sports and stuff like that. I found the process of writing it so therapeutic. Like, it was probably the most therapeutic thing I've done. Like, counselling, I've done every sort of a thing. Reiki, you name it, I've done it. And I found it so freeing. Like, I said things in the book and I said things to Niall even when we were writing it that I'd never said out loud. And I've just found it very freeing. And I'm proud of it. And, like, it's, I think it's there. And people are always like, oh, did it sell well and all that? And I'm like, I actually haven't a notion. I couldn't tell you. It was never about that. I said when I signed the contract, I remember Gil came to me about writing a book and I was like, oh God, I haven't thought about this, like, obviously. And I had to do a brief for it on, like, the reason I wanted to do it or whatever. And I remember sitting down and thinking at the end of it, like, if this can just be there for the girls or the guys that are going through this, that are up at night and need answers to something or just want that loneliness, that feeling of nobody gets this, and maybe feeling like, okay, somebody does get this. Or maybe somebody who is somebody in their life who's going through something like that and they want to understand and to help. Because there's not an awful lot there. And, you know, like, I'd look at my family and they so wanted to help. And they'd say something and I'd eat them. They'd be after saying the wrong thing, you know, and from what I wanted to hear. And that's all I wanted the book to do. And, yeah, it's been a lovely process. I think it's been really, really nice.
Look, Blanid, I know that couldn't have been easy for you there, telling your story, but like I said earlier, like, we need more women like you out there. Like, you're strong, you're powerful, you told that story with such conviction there, your story, and I think it's going to help so many women out there that are probably in the process or dealing with PTSD from their events or events, is that the right word? Probably not.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just think, like I said earlier as well, Sarah Grace was in with us a few years ago. People like you and Sarah,
you can see similar traits with them.
Yeah. Like, is
they're very, witty and bubbly, and it's very unsettling for us.
Like, yeah.
But we're coming in here daunting. We're like,
but you know what, lads? This is something, like, you don't understand. You say, like, oh, you know, how good that is. You don't understand how good it is to get women on podcasts with two lads, you know, two young lads, and how hard that is. The amount of, I did a fundraiser for the Rape Crisis Centre and I tried to get every influencer, every sports star to share this fundraiser, and I raised something like 40,000. It was so hard to get men to share it. It was so, so hard. I couldn't get anyone. There's so many women. Podcasts, it's so hard. Interviews with men. And I think it's like such a fear, like, that, because it's a really uncomfortable conversation. Yeah. And I totally get it. So you don't understand the impact that that has, the audience that you're opening these stories up to, that, like, women can tell these stories all day long, but it's so hard to get them to maybe a male audience or maybe an audience who wouldn't get them somewhere else. So that's even more critical. Like, there's, you know, that's huge, and that's so, so hard to get. And I don't think you understand the gravity of what you're doing by letting people tell a story like that, like letting women come on and tell those stories, because we don't get that opportunity. And I think, yeah, it's really uncomfortable, and I'm sure it is, because I know when I try and talk to the men in my life about it, I can see them, they're like, oh God, please don't ask me, like I'm going to say the wrong thing, or I'm going to insult her or upset her, like what am I going to do if she cries or something like that. So you don't understand, you know, what you're doing either. Yeah, like that's huge.
Yeah. But that's why I was curious about what is our relationship with men now, because I do feel that young men now, there's just so much out there that's like, if you like this person, well, that's the manosphere kind of thing, and you better be thinking this way. So we're kind of trying to juggle that in the middle. So that's why it's like, I'm afraid to say something in case I'm labelled one of these
more things. Or the other, yeah. And like, it's very hard, like that whole manosphere thing is really hard too, because like it's such a big thing, and yeah, it's so toxic, and we all know them. We, you know, we saw the Louis Theroux documentary. We were all, you know, but like, there's very few people there challenging that. Like, I know that people don't agree with them, but it's very hard then to find people who are openly like challenging that.
Yeah,
that's so important. You're normal thinking lads, and that's what we need. But you're not afraid to be like, okay, well, you know, let's have the awkward conversation. And you know, it's awkward for a second, or you think, oh God, that's uncomfortable. And then you move on and you start talking about it, and it's grand, you know. And like, I do think that really comes, that this whole, you know, but like, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't rape somebody. I wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
But it's like, we have a massive problem with violence against women. Huge, huge problem. And I think the attitude is there, it's like, it's just the bad people's problems. There's only a few bad actors in this, you know, there's only those few bad guys, and we don't see that it's actually a massive problem for everyone. You know, like you're saying, like your daughter, to protect your daughter, things like, not protect your daughter, but you know, that you can have those conversations with your daughter, that if something happens to her, she can come to you and talk to you. Like those things are so, so important. We all have a role against it. And if I think if we don't have those conversations, people still stay in that really awkward, I don't know how to address this, I don't know how to navigate this, you know. And then that also kind of puts people off reporting things, because they think, well, if I tell somebody that this happened to me, they're not going to believe me, they're not going to understand, they're not going to know how to support me, I'm going to be on my own, you know. So that all feeds into it. So I think having these open conversations mightn't, you know, somebody might be listening to it who'll never be affected with sexual violence, but somebody in their life might, and it might give them a bit of an understanding of maybe what they're feeling, you know. So there's different sides to it. Yeah,
it's educating people.
Yeah,
we have to educate people on what's right and what's wrong.
Yeah,
and why something is wrong and why something is right. And that's the thing as well, people need to know more on like what is consent, what is rape, because then when these trials do come out in the public, and people can be like, oh, I didn't know that what that's
what
that's
not what that is.
Whereas people are like, no, actually, this thing can happen.
Yeah.
Like what you were saying there, like some people stay away from men, some people get more promiscuous.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like people are like, what's going on?
It's a
spectrum.
Yeah. Or like they might say, but like, oh, you know, but she was raped, but she slept with somebody after, you know, weeks afterwards. Like, you know, they can't understand that, you know, trauma presents itself in different ways, and then, you know, all those sorts of things. Like, and it is, it's just an understanding thing. But I do think that information hasn't been there until now. There hasn't been that there, but it's a huge, huge piece. And yeah, it's interesting. I think it's important. It's that bit that I'd love to kind of crack, I think.
Blana, is there that you need to plug or would like to plug before we wrap up?
Not at all.
You have nothing coming up or anything like that?
No.
What's the name of the book?
It's called Aftermath.
And where can people find you on socials?
Blonad Rally on Instagram. And just like I always say to people who are listening, if there's anybody who has any questions, if I can help anybody with like court stuff, or they're just haven't told anybody and they're on their own and they don't know what to do, I'll always answer a message on Instagram. So fire ahead. I mightn't be able to help a lot, but if I can do anything, I always try.
Brilliant. Blonde, you're amazing. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Alright, take us out of it.
Boom.
That's us for this week, and thanks to the legends at Roystyle Furniture for supporting the podcast.
Speaking of great support, see what I did there? Roystyle has everything, and I mean everything. Sofa sorted, beds covered, dining table, 6 chairs, boom. All in one house package. Plus the lads in the store are sound. They're not pushy, just helpful. And if you're an online shopper, no problem.
Visit www.roystyle.ie, and when you shop in store, tell them that the two boys from the podcast sent you, and they'll throw you in a little discount.
Don't sleep on this deal, unless it's on one of their mattresses, in which case, fair play.
So get down and get the gaff sorted. Right price, Roystyle, right now.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Go your way in it now. Till your body attend. Work it hard and long. When you finish that.
The hip knocker.
Go down.